Hey, thanks for downloading the podcast. And remember, if you want to listen live, download the iHeartRadio app, download the TuneIn app, and just search for Fantasy Sports Radio Network, and you can listen to this program live. Also, if you want to watch the video of this podcast, check us out on YouTube, on Twitch, or on Periscope, and type in, you guessed it, Fantasy Sports Network. You'll find us there. Enjoy the show, and thanks for listening.
You're listening to the best of the Roto Experts in the Morning.
Great work again by George Kurtz. He always gets it done out there on rotoexperts.com, the mark of fantasy excellence. Every Tuesday, he comes out with an article kind of giving you a snapshot and a status update on the kind of movements at the back end of the bullpen. And Scott, there's a couple of situations I want to dive into with you now. First off, in Cincinnati, remember last week, Scott, when I said how pissed off I was that someone in my league beat me in the race to the computer because you said it was Bush League with the waivers and that I wanted Jared Hughes because I saw Iglesias go on the DL? Well, it looks like I'm actually happy that I didn't have to go ahead and get Jared Hughes because his time is probably up. They're saying Iglesias is going to be back pretty quickly, maybe even today because this is the end of the 10 days. It was retroactive to May 20th. Do you expect Iglesias to just take his job back right away? Or, you know, like we saw at Corey Knebel in Milwaukee, him have to kind of work up to it a little bit?
Yeah, Knebel was out for a while, so they wanted to ease him back in. Iglesias will probably just go right back into the job. I can't imagine they would use Jared Hughes against him. Hughes did a nice job. He got three saves while he was out. He did his job. But then again, the Cincinnati doesn't get a lot of save opportunities either. So it's nothing to sweat unless you were desperate for a closer.
Fair enough, you know, and some people are, though, you know, that the difference of a couple of saves, especially in some roto leagues, can definitely get you points. I'm on, you know, Scott, I personally, and I know no one likes to hear about someone else's fantasy team, but I'm in second place in a roto right now, but I am, you know, I'm only getting like 4 points for saves in this 12-person league, but I have Britton coming back. I just got Knebel. I have Nate Jones, who assumed the role. So I'm expecting to kind of, you know, start to ascend in that category. And I really think that could be the margin for me to maybe even take over first place.
I think Jones hasn't had a save in like 9 days.
That's okay, though. He is. Yeah. Let's go there, though. He is, in fact, the closer, it looks like, for the Chi Sox. It's not Joaquin Soria anymore. So you think Nate Jones has a grasp on that role, though?
He does, but, you know, his last save came well over a week ago.
Fair enough. It's similar, like you just said, Cincinnati, they're not winning a ton of games. Neither is Chicago, you know, but these are saves that you can get. You know who is winning a lot of games, Scott? The Houston Astros are winning a lot of games. And listen, Hinch just doesn't have that much faith in Ken Giles. Listen, I saw the game last night. You know, it was Davinsky in there in the ninth with a 2-run lead. He gave it up with a shot to Brett Gardner. But is Giles' grasp on that role getting tenuous?
It has been tenuous.
Yeah.
He's had some blow-ups this year. And then when Hinch is kind of like moved him out of the role for a short period, he's kind of recaptured it. It's interesting because all of his blow-ups have come in non-save situations. He's converted all of his save opportunities. You know, he got hammered around this week, but they brought him in a non-save situation. That's why I believe in the closer mentality. Sometimes when you see these guys, they come in into a non-save situation and they're used to it. They don't perform as well. The adrenaline's not flowing the same as they often talk about. So, you know, if you're gonna send a fire truck out for a closer, I think I think that Giles is still going to be the guy, but I wouldn't be surprised if this team makes a move this is a team that's still going to contend for a championship, and I still think they're the best team in the American League. Is this a team that maybe trades for Kelvin Herrera and see you know if he can get the job done? Because
let's talk about that some more, Scott.
I'm a little worried about Giles. I certainly am.
Listen, they didn't have faith in him in the playoffs last year.
I still think he's number one there, but Hinch was saying already that he wasn't going to use him last night in the same situation.
Yeah, exactly. So you bring up a very interesting point. Listen, there's other closer situations that we know. Go check out the article from George Kurtz. He outlines things like Melanson making rehab start appearances in San Francisco and his path to returning, what Alex Colomé's move to Seattle means. You know, it's anyone's guess, as we discussed in the Toronto Blue Jays. You know, we got Clifford, Tapera, maybe even Axford, you know, George Kurtz breaks that down, but I think you make a very interesting point. You know, we saw Colomé, let's say, get traded, no longer in the closer role. I was on Fantasy Freestyle, also right here on the Fantasy Sports Network on Tuesday nights, and I was talking to my fantasy best friend forever, Mike Florio, and I was talking about a couple of bullpen arms. Herrera's definitely one that you mentioned that I expect to get moved. And then we were talking about teams that we think could be in the market for the closer. You mentioned Houston making a move because of the lack of faith in Giles. We thought a couple of other places, Scott. The three places we thought that are contenders that may want to try to pull the trigger on a guy like Herrera or a bullpen arm were the Angels, the Phillies, and the Braves. What do you think? You think those three teams might also be in the market for some bullpen help?
I would say the Angels and the Phillies. I don't know about the Braves.
They've talked about Vizcaino being kind of up and down. Remember, there's a couple of, you know, we were wondering about Vizcaino's grasp on that job a month ago.
I don't really think, though, that they're a team that is considered a true contender. I think it depends on where they are and what they want to spend. I don't
You're talking
know
about
if
the Braves,
make a major
first
move.
Place in the NL East, 10 games over.
Yeah, you know, at the end of May, which is nice, but
fair.
I don't know if we expect that to to stay.
The sustainability,
The sustainability of it. I'm not so sure about it. I like the other two situations that you talked about a little bit better.
So wait, is
you
that
know,
the
Angels?
Think...
The Angels certainly have to make a move because,
right?
Because you know they really don't know what's going on there. Kenny
it's a committee,
Middleton,
like we're saying,
was the guy, but you know now he's out for the year here, and Miami's probably going to see a change in the closure situation. They'll probably move Brad Ziegler, and then you know you might see Drew Steckenrider get the chance to close for that team.
So, Scott, is that to say then you have, you know, we talk about the sustainability, right?
Brad Hand is
Yeah, I'm going to get into some of these guys. There's a couple of options. I want to get into some of them. But before we get into specific relievers, Scott, so is that to say you believe kind of in the Phillies sustainability more than the Braves? Because you said you'd have thought the Braves might.
Washington is eventually going to gain a comfortable lead overall the rest of the division.
You know, so I'm just asking, though, because you said, you know, you didn't know that they were going to contend in a sustainable way, but that you did think the Angels could make a move, and you did think that the Phillies might want to make a move. And so I'm asking you, do you think the Phillies want to make a move
because they don't even have somebody as good as Vizcaino at the back end. You know, they're really struggling.
Right. So Neris, you know, kind of doesn't, you know, keep people comfortable and satisfied. Let's talk about some of these names. You talk about Herrera. Right. I like what you mentioned in Brad Hand.
He's playing great in
San Diego. Like, listen, we've talked about the Royals being open for business, whether it is Herrera, Duffy, Moustakas is also, you know, kind of on a 1-year deal. These are guys that are probably going to move. Let me ask you this, Scott. If you have Kelvin Herrera and you're probably, you know, you're expecting him to get moved, what happens if it's like a Colomé situation where he moves to a team where he goes into a new role, a seventh or an eighth inning role? Are you trying to get ahead of this by, I don't know, gauging the market for Herrera? Like, how are you handling it if you have Kelvin Herrera on your team right now? And what happens if, like, you're in an AL-only league and he gets traded
about
to the
this.
NL?
We talked about this last week. The trade value is not going to be high.
Okay.
You take what you can get out of him while you get it. You know, we talked about this already with Colomé, and it's the same type of situation. You don't know if he's going to be traded out of your player universe or his role or whatever, and other people are not going to be willing to give up more than, I say, like 50, 60 cents on the dollar for that.
All right, so let's say, what percent chance you think, Scott, that Kelvin Herrera does in fact get traded?
I think I would say there's about a 65% chance he gets traded.
All right, so you like that to happen. You talked
about
Brad Hand.
Maybe I'm underestimating it.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think he's definitely going to go. He is an asset that Kansas City can use to restock kind of what they need over there. You talk about Brad Hand as well in San Diego. They're not going anywhere. People like him. He's also a lefty out of the pen, which is also interesting, right?
Rare for a closer, yeah.
It is very rare. So I would think there's even more potential for a guy like Hand to get traded and be in a different role, right? For a team, a contending team, maybe they view him as a lefty specialist as opposed to a closer. What do you think likelihood that Hand is on the move in the next 2 months?
Well, you make some great points here, because he would be a tremendous lefty out of a bullpen. You have to look at a team that's already stacked and maybe is looking for that sort of specialist,
right?
And actually, I could see maybe the Yankees making a play.
Yeah, I was going to say that. They could use a lefty,
not that they need bullpen improvement necessarily.
But they are righty dominant between, you know, Betances and Robertson, Canely, all these guys.
I mean, if you look at the rich getting richer kind of thing, I think if he's going to go to a non-save situation, that is an excellent spot for him to go to.
Okay, that's interesting. A couple more guys I want to bring up in this vein. We talked about Nate Jones. I know you say that the Chi Sox don't give him many opportunities, but he does have closer stuff. Do you think he could be on the move? Is it above or below 50% in your opinion for Nate Jones?
Probably like a little below 50%. You know, they've been waiting for him to come back for a while. This is a guy I think that could be traded. If he's traded away from the Sox, though, probably wouldn't get a lot of save chances.
Yeah, so maybe he's one of your bridge kind of guys, a seventh or an eighth inning guy for someone else. Remember last year or a couple years ago when the White Sox traded David Robertson to, you know, the Yankees, he goes from being kind of a closer type to a seventh inning guy. The last team I want to talk about in this vein as we finish up hour number one here on Roto Experts in the Morning on the award-winning Fantasy Sports Radio Network. Holler at us if you want at 844-843-6879 in our second hour. Scott, Baltimore. We got to look at Baltimore, right? I mean, you know, it seems like Zach Britton is going to start a rehab assignment today. That means he's going to probably be back sometime next week. They've been saying early June for him for a while. Couldn't the Orioles just flip all these guys? Couldn't the Orioles wind up trading Britton if he's healthy, trading Brock, even trading a guy like O'Day if he comes back and can be healthy? If you're the Orioles, shouldn't you just flip them all?
I think that's kind of extreme and not realistic as to what Major League Baseball teams do. I'm not saying it's impossible to happen, but I think it would be unusual. I think Britton's the guy that gives him a lot of value and somebody they would like to flip.
Okay, but you don't think they would also then trade? So let me ask you this. Let's say you are a Brad Brock owner, right, Scott? And you're kind of thinking, uh-oh, Britton's coming back. That kind of null and voids most. I mean, you know, there's holes and stuff like that, but that really kills most of Brock's value, right? So would you kind of, if you're a Brock owner, be like, wait a second, let me hold on to this because there's so much buzz about Britton being on the move. Maybe come, you know, August 15th, Brock is right back in the closer role.
Yeah, maybe come August month. Yeah, Brock's the closer. Yeah.
But so would you hold on to him a little bit more?
I like that, though. So, yeah, I'm okay with holding on to him,
You're okay with holding on to him because, remember, like you said, people are going to move and people are going to be in other roles, and it sounds like Buck and the Orioles really think that Brock is, you know, he is the next man up. He's been in that role. He does have about 8 or 9 saves already, so maybe he can, in fact, be the guy with the expected return and then movement of a guy like Zach Britton. I'm telling you, Scott, if I were them, I'd flip them all. I'll tell you what, and I know this would be kind of controversial. If I'm, you know, we talk about the bats that are out there. You know, the Baltimore may trade Machado, you know, as well. I mean, I'd break it down if I was Baltimore. I know he's kind of like Captain America to that team, but Adam Jones, would he have a market?
I think he certainly would if they're willing to move him. I don't know what – I haven't heard any rumors that they're trying to move him.
But if you're Baltimore, you know, we talk about this all the time, Scott, with teams, you know, that are not that are tanking in the NBA or rebuilding, shall we say. The Baltimore Orioles are 17-38, Scott. They have two of the best teams in the majors, in the Red Sox and Yankees, in that division. If they take a look in the mirror, right, don't they have to realize that Adam Jones, while has been a great service to that organization for over a decade, you know, is not going to be part of the squad whenever they are back on the upswing part of the cycle, you know. And Machado, he ain't signing there. So, like, when do they cut their losses and, you know, kind of be honest with themselves and do what they have to do for the future?
It's a valid point, but I haven't heard any rumors that Adam Jones is going to be on the move.
Well, let me start the rumors right now, Scott. That's what I'm doing. That's what the spitting statistician does.
Well, you speculate, no. You speculate.
I am.
It's legitimate speculation, but
it's kind of like an educated guess.
There's nothing solid.
Right?
It's
no, I haven't heard any reports. I haven't heard any reports. What I am doing, though, is putting two and two together and getting four. You know what I mean? Like, if you're.
It's hard to get four, though, if you don't have the plus sign. Which is the plus sign is there are there any actual rumors out there?
Two to the second power, baby. That's what it is. I square it with my rumors. Brandon Marshall does in fact sign with the Seattle Seahawks. Could this be a case where he continued his roadshow and found no real interest? What do you think about this signing and the fit, Brandon Marshall in Seattle, Jake?
Yeah, well, there wasn't a lot of options left at this point. I mean, this is a landing spot we talked about last week where I said it made a lot of sense for Dez Bryant. And Brandon Marshall is not too dissimilar in the fact that they're not exactly the same wide receiver, but they're on the downside of their career. But the thing that you only really cared about at this point is they're both still good red zone threats. And it has nothing to do with, oh, Brandon Marshall's tall and Dez Bryant. No, that's just what their skill set is. They've always been that. Neither
good
one
at the
of them
point
have
of the catch.
Right. Neither one of them have ever been that amazing at separating from defenders. Never. They've always been, as you said, they're good at the point of the catch. They can body out players. They know how to attack the ball in the air. And they're good because of that, especially in the red zone. And the size does help. It's not just because of the size. And you see people out there, you know, they're talking about the fact of how many opportunities inside the 5-yard line went to Doug Baldwin and other people and stuff like that. I think that's diving down too far the analytics. The fact is when you're inside the 10-yard line, whether it was always the Doug Baldwin or something, the fact is opportunities are going to be there. Jimmy Graham was not always the option. Jimmy Graham was an option often. Baldwin wasn't the option all the time. He was they're all in the mix. And the fact is Jimmy Graham's not there anymore. They need somebody else for opportunities. And that's what we want to try and predict in fantasy football is opportunities, because opportunities will often result in the production. So just focus on the opportunities. There's a lot of people that tweeted about it yesterday. I think Scott Barrett was one of them that showed that just opportunities in running backs and wide receivers is all that matters. It actually matters more for fantasy points than anything else. And that's what you're looking for here. It's a knock to everybody down the line. You know, I don't think he's the second most talented wide receiver. You can make an argument for Tyler Lockett, but it certainly hurts Tyler Lockett, Darboe, as you mentioned, any other wide receiver for the Seahawks at this point. Except
opportunity doesn't lead to production too, and Marshall to me is a guy that's caught three touchdown passes in the last 2 years, and the skills have faded. Yeah, you look at the size and the point about Baldwin, he's not a red zone receiver.
Right.
He can score from winning the five by being creative, but he's not a red zone receiver. There's no guarantees that Marshall even makes this team. This is a flyer. You know, the Seahawks, I can make an all-star team of team history where they've took flyers on guys at the end of their careers and it hasn't worked out, or it has, like Franco Harris at running back, didn't work out. Warren Moon at quarterback, I'm just having fun here, it did work out. You know, got guys like that. Jerry Rice at the end of his career.
Right.
And now Brandon Marshall. There's no guarantees he even makes the squad. Darboe, I don't think it's really a knock on him, because I think Darboe's going to play a different role than him. You know, but Darboe is not a big red zone type. So I don't think it hurts Darboe. To me, it's interesting. You know, a super deep sleeper for me on this roster right now Jimmy Graham gone, if Marshall still can't do it, Tanner McElvoy is a guy that's in his third year out of Wisconsin. The team likes him. I don't think anybody realizes not only does he get downfield, the guy is 6'6", 230. So if Brandon Marshall doesn't have anything left and Tanner McElvoy has a good camp, mark it down. This guy is a super deep sleeper.
Interesting. The King, Scotty Angle, digging in the crates up in the Pacific Northwest to come up with McAvoy. But to your point, Jake, you know, we always – that's why I asked you a few shows ago. We talked about what I'm now calling the XYZ affair in American history. You know, we talk about different types of receivers, right? Baldwin is kind of like the slot guy, a great, you know, great wide receiver nonetheless, but a different archetype. You talk about Tyler Lockett. This is a guy that's in space. This is a guy that has speed down the field. And so maybe he does fill that Jimmy Graham kind of red zone role a little bit for targets inside the red or the green zone. But Jake, let me ask you this. I mean, you talk about the targets kind of being spread evenly. Couldn't that possibly be because Russell Wilson is playing schoolyard football, running for his life a lot of times? There's so many plays that are off script. And so at that point of the play, you kind of all bets are off about the play design and it's whoever can break free. Could that be part of why, like, maybe the targets are kind of spread? Russell Wilson's running for his life half the time.
I think that's kind of overstating what Russell Wilson's doing a lot of times. The offensive line hasn't been that bad until last year, had its worst struggles. But the fact is, it's just Russell Wilson doesn't target anybody specifically. He goes to who's open, and Doug Baldwin is the number one, and then everybody else is in the mix after that. And one of the things that this is one of the reasons I've never been on the Seahawks' number two wide receiver is because they don't use any of them consistently. Like, if you look at the depth chart and it was listed, this is their number two wide receiver, that doesn't mean that's going to be the number two wide receiver all year long in production or even targets on the field. They're very flexible with who's the opportunity that they need to use and exploit matchup-wise, and then Russell Wilson's going to who's open. He's not forcing things. He's not looking right for the second guy every single time. He's just that good of a quarterback, and that's what it has to do with. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's, like, scrambling all the time.
Yeah, and I think that's a knock to Marshall because, you know, Jake expertly talks about, you know, even early throughout his career, Russell Wilson has been all about extending the play. And can Brandon Marshall at 34 years old keep up with that, you know, with the type of scrambling and, you know, creativity on the fly that the receivers have to do? Amari Darboe has always already been in the system for a year. And you have to remember another factor, too. Seattle did use Jimmy Graham basically as their goal line back last year because they didn't have anybody who could punch it in the red zone for short yardage.
Now they have Russell Wilson as their goal line back, not Jimmy Graham.
No, Russell Wilson wasn't the goal line back. He hardly ran for
Jimmy Graham, I thought.
I said Jimmy Graham was a goal line back, essentially, for the Seahawks last year.
He said Anthony Rizzo.
Yeah.
Oh, he caught 10 touchdown passes last year because the Seahawks didn't have a reliable running back to punch it in from short yardage. Got now you. They have Rashard Penny. There may not be a Jimmy Graham role this year. Now, of course, you want to have somebody in the red zone you can throw to so the defense just doesn't think running back. But I don't think Brandon Marshall comes in here and catches 7 touchdown passes.
Down in Miami, they're saying they are now, quote-unquote, taking it one day at a time with Devontae Parker. As I hear myself making it pop in the background, what's the deal on Devontae Parker? This guy now, for years, I've been expecting him to be the breakout kind of guy, you know, out of Louisville, and it just hasn't happened yet. Now, no Jarvis Landry there anymore. He could be primed and ready. Do you think he actually takes this step forward finally this year?
Are we doing this again? We're really doing this again with Devontae Parker? Like, how many times? Like, I'm a Devontae Parker supporter. I talked about his talent, and I talked about how great he was in college when he came out of the draft. At the same time, how many years are we going to do this? How many years are we going to keep playing this game where Devontae Parker,
this is season?
Exactly.
How about the same many times as we can see the Warriors and the Cavs, I guess. That's how many times. I don't know.
What we're doing. Here's what you need to be doing. You need to be doing what I'm doing, is laughing at everybody and taking the better Dolphins wide receiver in the 8th and 9th round as Kenny Stills is still sitting there staring you in the face, because Kenny Stills has outplayed him to this date. Kenny Stills has grown in his game to this date. Kenny Stills is actually still funny to follow on Twitter. But the fact is yes, Devontae Parker's ceiling is higher, and I have no problem taking him as a potential. You want to give him to me as my wide receiver 4? No problem. But the problem is people are doing – they're buying all the risk again. They're still taking him as a top 30-35 wide receiver, which is the stupidest thing in the world.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I am not – at this point for me, he's a – someone else could take the risk. I'm going to need to see it before I believe in it. Let me ask you to do this, because you're saying, like, are we gonna do this again? That the narrative, like, we already know about Devontae Parker. There was another top draft pick in that draft that we're also waiting on, Jake, as a wide receiver, and that's the kid out of Chicago, Kevin White. I believe they were both in the 2015 draft. We're waiting on Kevin White as well. You know, as you said, Matt Nagy is talking every day about a different Bear. He's also saying, like, this guy is, you know, first into the facility, last out of the facility, doing everything the right way. If I put a gun to your head and I said you had to believe in Parker or White for this year, where would you go?
Why do those have to be the choices? Why
because that's the conflict. That's the question I'm asking you, Jake.
Why was always got to put guns to people's heads?
Like that, fine. If I asked you to get off the fence that you are currently riding,
there is
which
no fence.
One, which way would
I
you go?
I told you what the answer was. It's Kenny Stills. I don't know why we're dragging these guys into it. It's Kenny Stills.
Well,
the
I'm
answer.
Juxtaposing it. I'm juxtaposing it against Kevin White, also a bust that has never fulfilled this from also, the 2015 draft as a top 20 draft pick.
The difference is Kevin White's got injury after injury after injury after injury after injury. So in between the two is going to be Devontae Parker, because at least Devontae Parker had the stretch of touchdowns at the end of the one season. At least he's got that going for him. I love Kevin White, and he's up there. The same thing. They're both at the top of the draft class in talent. There's no question in it. It's just Kevin
That's
White.
That's why I asked the question, Jake. That's why I asked the question.
Kevin White can't even get on the field. They drafted Anthony Miller. I don't see where Kevin White can break through. At least, like I said, Devontae Parker could be the number one. That's the difference there.
So there's still a path for Devontae Parker, whereas Kevin White's got a little bit too many guys to leapfrog, whether it's Miller, they signed Gabriel. You know they have AR-15 as well. But Jake doesn't like hearing about guns, so we're not going to talk about AR-15. We have Mike Leone on right now. Mike, how you doing this fine morning?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Mike. Listen, last week I asked you kind of, you know, with all these kids coming up and doing well, Gleyber Torres continuing to rake. We see what Austin Meadows is doing. I asked you if kind of like the pricing, you know, was not catching up to these kids performing right away. I want to ask you a different question about the pricing this week. We see what the Tampa Bay Rays are doing, right, with the opener. You know, Sergio Romo and others going just for an inning or an inning and a third at the beginning of the game. What does that do for the pricing? You know, for example, Ryan Yarbrough, for instance, you know, he's never going to be the quote-unquote starting pitcher, but I can tell on days where he might be pitching innings 2 through 6 and potentially in line for a win, his value, you know, his pricing has to be far lower. Is he someone I could even play with if I want to on the same day, say, go with a Chris Sale or a Max Scherzer and try to sneak it out? Do you think the pricing is ahead of what the Tampa Bay Rays are doing?
Yeah, you absolutely can use guys like Yarbrough, and we actually had him as a pretty good play when they faced the Orioles last week in a spot where, you know, like you said, expensive starting pitching, you want to pair him with, you want to get some bats in there, and he's not really priced like a regular starting pitcher. And not only are you getting a price discount on a guy like him, but you're getting an ownership discount in tournaments.
Right.
He went off at like 5% versus the Orioles, just because he wasn't listed as the starting pitcher, where if he was listed as the starting pitcher, he probably would have gone off at like 15 to 20%, 3 to 4 times higher. And it's actually a better spot for him to come in that second inning and not have to face those top three guys
sure.
in order. You know, he misses them the first time. So he's actually in a spot where his projection is going to be a little bit better than it would be. And yet he's very cheap, and he's lower owned than he would be if he's a starting pitcher. So there's not a lot of opportunity, or I shouldn't say there's not a lot of, but the opportunities to think outside the box in DFS sometimes start to whittle down just because there's so much information out there. A lot of people are up to speed on things. So it's fun to have a situation like this where you can kind of think critically about it and take advantage of something that maybe other people aren't seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned maybe in a GPP because the ownership is not going to be there. If you're ahead of the curve on this, you know, and that's what you're looking for in some of these big-time tournaments. You need to zig when other people zag, and you need to hit on it, right? So, yeah, maybe I'll on a two-pitch two-pitcher format, maybe I'll have Sale, maybe I'll have Scherzer. But then if I go, you know, completely different with someone that is not going to be high-owned and I can get an opportunity with a cheap win, and as you mentioned, he doesn't face the big boys in inning number two, you know, there could be an advantage there. Here's another thing I want to ask you about, Mike. You know, on Mondays, on Thursdays, there's generally shorter slates, right? Tonight, I think there's 9 games at night, maybe 11 games total on a Thursday, you know, when teams are traveling. Generally speaking, Mike, how do you manage your money? Let's say you're playing every day, right? But on Mondays and Thursdays, with less games, less of a player universe, is that more of an opportunity for sharks in the water, or do you maybe only go to cash games on those kind of days? Do you play it differently ever on days like Monday and Thursday where there's shorter slates?
I don't change it up too much unless it's a really short slate. For example, if it's a 9-game slate like it is tonight, mm-hmm. I play that pretty normal. Like
okay.
my bankroll allotment's not really going to change. When you get to like a 3 or 4 game slate, that's when I start to do things a little bit differently, where I'm going to scale back the amount of money I have in play. I might focus a bit more on tournaments than cash games because there's going to probably be heavy overlap in cash games. You don't want to get caught up in a situation where you're basically paying the rake because you've just got
right.
a lot of overlap with your competitors. And it can pay on those really short slates to be pretty contrarian in tournaments because it's really hard to do, because a lot of times there's one or two obvious offenses and it's tough to get away from them. But if you can mentally force yourself to do that, you know, just given the variance of baseball, I mean, we talk about it often. I know people probably sick of hearing the variance of baseball, but it's true. If you can get away from the really, really chalky offenses on like a 4 or 5 game slate, mm-hmm. You can put yourself in a position where you just need one or two offenses the foul, and all of a
right.
sudden you've created a ton of leverage on the field. But it's definitely something that's easier said than done when you've got like Colorado on a 4-game slate at home and they've got, you know,
mm-hmm.
a game, Vegas total in that game of 12 and everybody else is like 9. It's definitely easier said than done.
Yeah, fair enough, right? I mean, like, I guess it gives you a greater potential to almost like have the nuts, right? If you kind of stack and pick the right stack. But like you say, if Coors Field is one of the options, you know, you figure everyone's going to be there. Let's go a little bit deeper into today, Mike. We're talking with Mike Leone from DailyRoto.com. Listen, today, Mike, is the return of one Clayton Kershaw. He comes back from the DL facing the Phillies. The Phillies without Rhys Hoskins, you know, it looks like he's going to be on the DL for the foreseeable future with a jaw, you know, that fractured jaw. But here's the thing. I think most people, they say, Clayton Kershaw, put him right back in, you know. I kind of have cause for pause, Mike. You know, when he comes back, when he's been on the DL previously, when he comes back, they don't let him go the route right away. You know, he's not going to be out there pitching a complete game today. And to me, today at least, he fits in kind of the category of like Rich Hill with the Dodgers. Like, he may pitch great, but he may only go 5 1/3. You know, he may not get that win or that quality start. You know, kind of like we saw Alex Reyes yesterday, you know, pitch well, but only go 4 innings, only go 70 some odd pitchers. Do you think there's a chance for Kershaw to be strong like he usually is, but just not have the durability today? Or are you just comfortable running him out there as usual in his return?
I'm looking at it exactly the same way you're looking at it. He returned from the DL last season after some time off, and I believe he went 6 innings, but he only faced 20 batters. And he was, like you said, Rich Hill-esque. He was really good. He just didn't pitch deep. So even though he was efficient, he still couldn't pitch deep. You know, 20 batters faced is not a lot. These are the guys that generally face 25-plus batters in a given start. And in 2016, too, he returned from the DL, and I think he had a start that lasted 3 innings pitch. So when you're talking about someone that's as expensive as Clayton Kershaw, you really want to know that you're getting the bulk of the innings. I haven't seen an official pitch count on him or anything, but I really wouldn't be surprised if he was limited somewhat. And you start to limit him at all. I mean, you dock him even an inning, it's difficult for him
right.
to pop that price tag, and there's a lot of expensive bats to use on this slate. So it's a situation where all of a sudden he doesn't become optimal in cash games. And
yeah.
then when you look in tournaments, you know, it's tough to realize that ceiling. So the only way I'm playing him in tournaments is if you really think there's a chance that, you know, we're wrong and he's just going to face his normal allotment of hitters right out of the gate. If you don't think he's going to, I think even in tournaments, He's a pass. I did want to mention one thing. You mentioned Reese Hoskins is out for Philly, and this is more just like a broader point, even though it affects Kershaw specifically tonight. But you get these weird spots in MLB DFS where strikeouts are so important that sometimes you remove a big bat like Hoskins from the lineup, and you think it's really good from a DFS perspective, and the risk is certainly lower with the opposing starting pitcher, but you also remove some strikeout potential.
Right.
And that can sometimes have like a bigger impact on the projection. It's really weird because sometimes people look at our projections and like Stanton won't be in the lineup for the Yankees and the opposing starting pitcher's projection will actually go down a little bit. And people are like, what the heck? Stanton's not in the lineup. So that's this push and pull. It's definitely higher risk, higher reward to face these power strikeout guys. Right. But overall, that strikeout potential just means so much.
No, absolutely. You got to think about the way you earn points in DFS. That's what it comes down to, whether it's DFS or even season long, right? One of the biggest rules is know the settings, you know? And so you make a great point. Yeah. I didn't really think about that, Mike. You know, this idea that the strikeout bat, the power bat might not be there, so the risk of them going yard off you is less, but, you know, you may not pile up as many strikeouts. But I completely agree with you. Kershaw, listen, for him to be worth that price tag, he's going to have to go a little bit longer than I think he's going to go today. So let's say this, Mike, if we don't think Kershaw is the lock today, or at least for durability, where are you going on the hill today? You know, on Daily Roto, we talk about some guys like Quintana, Sean Newcomb, Aaron Nola, who has been really good. Lance McCullers is also for Houston, but he's facing Boston, so I don't know if I like that. Which of these kind of other mid-level or high mid guys you going if you're going away and trying to beat Kershaw tonight?
I like Jose Quintana a lot. Mm. I know he struggled quite a bit out of the gate. You know, he's got a 4.69 FIP, his K minus walk percentage. You got Celia on the next hour. He likes to take credit for Saab,
yeah.
I think is what he calls it.
His stat.
You know, it's nearly half of what it was last season. So he's really struggled, but with all that said, it's tough to be in a better spot than he is tonight. The Mets are dead last in weighted runs created plus against left-handed pitching. They've got a league-high 27% K rate against left-handed pitching. And guess what? No Cespedes, no Wilmer Flores, who crushes left-handed pitching. I mean, if Quintana can't get it done tonight, I don't know when he's going to get it done. And because he struggled, you're getting the price discount. He's in the mid-tier. That price is one of the lower points it's been all season long. So I know it's not a pitcher that you're probably going to feel comfortable with based on the performance this year, but when you put it all together, even when you do account for some of those struggles, he's the best value on the board.
All right. The only thing, though, Mike, you got to watch out for is, you know, you never know. There could be a fire out there before the game, and then if they have to evacuate, that could do something to Quintana's potential today as well. Are you concerned about the potential for fire when it comes to Quintana today?
I'm not. I think I feel like I'm missing something.
Oh, there was a fire in Citi Field. Oh, there was a big actual dumpster fire in Citi Field before the game yesterday.
An actual
Wow, actual. Yeah. The Twitter was ablaze, Mike, with all the kind of innuendo there. Everything from, you know, the representative dumpster fire to like, Citi Field also on the DL for the Mets. You know?
I guess I've been so consumed by the Colangelo stuff on Twitter.
Yeah, burner accounts, right? Fair enough. They're all one and the same, right? Burner accounts, fires, yeah. Go check that out, Mike. There was an actual fire before the game at Citi Field yesterday. Pretty apropos, depending on who you ask. Hey, let me ask you this, though, Mike. You talk about some high-end bats out there, right? And I need your help. Okay, Mike, as you know, we play Roto Clio, right, where we predict someone who's going to go yard every day or someone who's going to get a win. Unfortunately, Mike, you're 0-2 so far. You gave us Joey Gallo once. He did not go yard. Last week you gave us, I think it was Milwaukee, I think it was Santana you gave us, Domingo Santana, and he did not go yard. Listen, yesterday, right, I was all on this Rocky stack. I was like, oh, the Rockies. I'm going to go with a Rocky right-handed bat because I like the lefty-righty matchup against who was it yesterday?
Holland.
Was it? Yeah, against Holland, right? I was like, I like it. Rocky's at home. I'm definitely going. You know where I went? I went Trevor Story, and of course Nolan Arenado goes yard. Okay, so here's what I need. I need some insight, okay, because Scott's not here, so I can take advantage of this. Give me two players, Mike, one for yourself, but give me someone as a cheat sheet. Who's going yard today, Mike?
Okay, so I'll give you one of the guys I think is like not quite as popular and obvious is Alex Bregman.
Okay.
Drew Pomeranz has really struggled in terms of fly balls and basically all over the board. And Bregman's peripherals are awesome. I know his like actual surface stats and his ISO aren't crazy good so far this season, but a lot of his underlying peripherals are strong. So I like Alex Bregman a lot.
Okay.
After that, if this Yankees-Baltimore game gets played, I think you can see a lot of home runs on the Yankees side. There is a decent amount of rain in the forecast. You got to keep an eye out on that. So I'll go, you know, I'll
facing
be
Andrew Kastner. I like that too. You know, in yards. I'll take that.
Ooh.
The lefty back in the lineup. Interesting. Okay. So I'm going to take Bregman because I'm cheating off of you, but you're going to go Greg Bird. Hopefully you get off the schneid here, Mike, because I look to you for expertise. What's that?
I don't want to be like Celia and just take Stanton.
Nah, you can't take Stanton. You know, he takes JD Martinez like 60% of the time. I mean, I guess it's a smart move. You know, it's a smart move. But, you know, it's just we're trying to help people out over here. Let me ask you. You know, we got this poll question up, Mike. What do you think about the future of baseball? Will five-man rotation stay like 10 years from now? Will there be a six-man rotation? Will more teams try to use these bullpens or something else? What do you think? Is the five-man rotation going away?
I don't know if it's going away, but I think what the Rays are doing, starting with a reliever, you know, kind of see what the Brewers are doing with Hader, giving him more innings pitched. I think you'll see people maximize that unless the rules change, because I do think it might be interesting if we see some rule changes to kind of force more balls in play somehow, whether it's moving the mound back or it's limiting the amount of available pitchers on a team. Because right now it's all about ramping up velocity, getting strikeouts,
right,
and you've got enough guys to cover the innings.
Jake, we also try to put the fun in functional sports radio, okay? And we're going to start next week. We're starting a few things next week, Jake. One of the things being our face of baseball tournament. You know, our brackets to see who is it that maybe, you know, took over for Derek Jeter or David Ortiz as the face of baseball. We've been batting around these first-round matchups and these seedings. I want to get final thoughts because we're launching this on Monday. Here are how the first-round matchups would play out at this point, Jake. And I want to see from you, which do you think is possible for an upset, if any? What we have is the 1 seed Bryce Harper and the 16 seed Yoenis Cespedes. I think Harper probably walks in that one, right? We got Aaron Judge versus Noah Syndergaard in the 2-15 matchup. I think Judge dominates that one. We got a 3-14.
I think that'll be interesting, honestly.
Yeah? All right, so we'll see. We'll see what the people in New York say about that. Number three seed, Jose Altuve against 14 seed Manny Machado, middle infielders. I think Altuve, people know and love Altuve, the 5'6" MVP. I think he advances pretty easily, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Weekdays, 7 a.m. Eastern on FNTSY Radio and on your popular podcast providers.